Thank you. Thank you, Eka. So today, since I don't know the background of all the gentlemen here, I will try to do some introduction and then I go into the detail. So we want to look at multi-way interactions between turbulent flows and suspended particles. And I'll do some introduction about different flows that have particles, turbulent flows with particles. Then I will do some DNS, direct numerical simulation of isotropic turbulence in which particles are smaller, the size of the particle is smaller than the smallest length scale of turbulence called Kolmogorov scale. We call it eta. And then I will do a homogeneous shear flow that has particles as well, but point particles. Then after that, I go to isotropic turbulence that has much larger particles. The diameter is about Taylor length scale. I will explain eta and lambda and do a summary. But please feel free to ask any questions while I'm talking because I don't know the audience.
We will, don't worry.
Okay.
This so,
right, okay. So this picture seen many years ago, a sandstorm in Melbourne, Australia. And I guess if some weather predictor want to predict the dispersion of these particles, they have to know turbulence, they have to know particles influence in turbulence, and they have to do also simulations. This is a recent one in January this year in a small town in the Indian Ocean, western part of Australia, and the height is 500 meters. Again, if you want to know the dispersion of these, of the movement of these storms in time, you need to know more about turbulence and particles.
Can we go back?
Sure.
Is this picture taken from the ocean, and is it like an offshore wind, or where does it come from?
So this is taken from the ocean, and these things here are small tankers, actually big tankers, right?
How far offshore are we?
I don't know. But the height is about half a kilometer. Yeah. I just got on the web. But this is very close to the shore. What was written underneath, it's close to the shore of that city called Onslow. This is in 2001 from the Hubble telescope. And in June, this the surface of Mars, and in September like this. If this happened on Earth, all the continents on Earth would be covered with sand. That's a major event, global event. And why this is important is when we land on Mars in about 20 or 25 years, we want to communicate with laser beams. And you can see here that the short travel time of a light signal between Earth and Mars, 3 minutes, depending on the location, and the longest, 21 minutes. So right now, when you communicate with a robot, you send one signal, one piece of information with the radio signal, and it can take 20 minutes. But if you have people there, you need to be if emergency or anything. So the future will be a laser beam, it takes the same time, like a radio signal, but it will be packed with gigabytes of data. So there'll be stations in South Africa and Australia and all this, sending laser beam directly to Mars. However, Mars surface have a lot of sandstorm all the time. So you need to understand the dispersion of these particles and interaction with the laser beam. There are many studies at MIT now exactly for this problem. So you need to know turbulence, particles, and interaction. It's an old picture of Mount St. Helens, 1980. You've seen how the impact on traffic, aircraft traffic. This week, or November, Mount Etna. And this satellite picture, if you want to see the jet behavior here, and you have all the weather conditions, you would like also to know how the jet travels laden with particles. So in 1980, in 1979, we made an experiment like this. It was before Mount St. Helens, but it was for other application, but very similar. So we had a turbine jet laden with glass beads, about 50 microns, and we wanted to know the impact of the particles on the jet behavior. At that time, people knew about single-phase turbine jets, and we wanted to know what would happen to particles. And you find out if you have no particles at all, the mean velocity of the gas will look like this. These are measurements. If you put particles with 32% mass fraction, the gas phase jet becomes narrower, and the centerline velocity increases, and the solid particles even have higher mean velocity, although they were injected at the same velocity from the nozzle. Yes.
It was buoyant particles.
That means there is gravity acting. Yes, yes. It's in the laboratory. We did this in 1979, but was published later.
And it's downward.
Downward, correct. Yes, yeah.
And so the initial velocity of the particles is the same as that.
Correct. Yeah, 12.6 meter per second. We had designed a glass container like this, 30 diameters of the nozzle, to ensure no impact.
And do you remember the Stokes note of the particles?
Mm-hmm. Right, so these are 50 micron particles, so they were smaller than the Kolmogorov scale of the jet. And I can tell you more details. It's on AIAA 1984. That's an important thing. So the idea is, although this work was done for NASA for a different application, but it applies to any volcano or anything. If you have the same, of course, volcanoes have much higher Reynolds number. The important thing is, when you put particles in a jet, the jet becomes narrower. What do you mean by jet narrower? That means it doesn't split laterally. It means it doesn't mix with the environment. And I'll explain to you why this happens. And when we increase the mass loading from 32% to 85%, the gas jet becomes even narrower. And the solid particles also narrower. See, so from zero particles, 32% particles to 85% particles. So it's a monotonic narrowing of the jet. It's very crucial. And the reason is, we will know more about this, that in order for a turbine jet to interact with the surrounding, entrain more fluid and expand, mixing of any scalar, you need the Reynolds stresses. These are the mixing, not the molecular stresses, but the Reynolds stresses, U prime, V prime. And if you have no particles, you get the value 0.16, which has been measured by many people, maximum here. If you put the particles, 32%, look at that. Cutting the Reynolds stress, that's why no mixing, and the jet becomes an narrower. So particles kill turbulence for these cases. This was done for this flow here. NASA wanted to know why the contrails spread for 10 miles after the aircraft already left. And the reason is that a turbulent jet that has water droplets or ice crystals from the combustion process, and they much narrower jet. And actually, if you look at this picture in detail, you see the inside one, they spread more because they're protected from the cold, from the lower temperature outside. So if the droplets vaporize, you would not see them. So you only see them for a long distance because turbulence has been reduced and the mixing with the surrounding has been reduced. But the same conditions apply to other flows with particles. The density ratio here is 1,000 to 1. And the other thing, when you have particles, probably 2,000 to 1. Or if you have heavier metal, it would be 5,000.
Do the particles influence the spectrum of the turbulent velocity fluctuations uniformly, or do they?
Fantastic question. So we'll do that in detail. This is just to show you that the knowledge we had in 1980. But to me, this is show and tell. For me, I wanted to know precisely what happens, and that's why DNS was the only way to do it. In rivers, you can have all these phenomena happening. So there are many people working on these things here, saltation and Shields number and all this. But I'm interested in suspended clay particles in the river like this. What do they do to the river? So here's a question. Would suspended sediment decrease or increase the bulk velocity of the river flow? So I'll keep this to the very end of the lecture to see what you may be experts in this. This is an important question. I saw this picture about May or so before Chateau meeting, and I kept asking, there is so, but anyway, we will come back to this. So keep in mind now, I'll go further. River flows are always turbulent. Any river flow is a turbulent flow unless you put a dam on it. Kolmogorov, who started his lecture in Moscow State University by asking what the surface velocity of the Volga River would be if by some miracle it became laminar. The answer is surface velocity will be hundreds of kilometers per second. And that's a Volga River.
It was the same flow rate.
I beg your pardon?
It was the same flow rate.
If you have the same pressure gradient, not flow rate. Same pressure gradient. I'll explain that. So this DNS in 2007 by Maruzic and Joseph, if you have a channel flow and you subject it to a pressure gradient, you will see that the laminar flow will look like this and the turbulent flow like this. And the shear stress of the turbulent flow is much higher than the wall. And you can see for the same pressure gradient, so that's what Kolmogorov was talking about, although that's many years before this paper here. And the same paper said the laminar bulk velocity over turbulent velocity can get 100 to 1,000 times for the same pressure gradient. And there's an equation for it. And that's a DNS. And this is analytical from this equation here. So it can be shown if you fix a pressure gradient, the laminar flow will be much faster. And so that keep that in mind when we answer the question about the river I showed you. So that's an introduction. And now why we're doing this. So the reason for doing the study is to understand the physics of two-way, four-way coupling between turbulence and particles. And why is that? Because this understanding is a prerequisite to do any subgrid scale modeling for LDS or RANS model, which are cheaper than DNS. So the idea here is to go deeper and deeper to do the details of physics that you cannot afford to do that for practical flows. And for people who do practical flows, they use RANS or LDS, they should get some information from us. So somebody here doesn't know the length scales of turbulent, I just a small introduction here. If you have a jet like this, and we color the fluid from the nozzle as red, and surroundings blue, and the mixing happens, and you can get different colors here, presenting concentration of the fluid that came from here. And by mixing, you dilute that, and so on. And if you make a cross-section of that jet, this was in a real jet at UCI done by Professor Petrakis, laser-induced fluorescence. He doped the jet by acetone. And you can see here that this is the jet fluid, and black is an artificial color for the air, and the mixing of different colors. So this is more concentration and so on. And if you look at the jet and you do more measurements, you would see the largest length scale in the jet is about this, about 1/10 of the diameter. Now, what do you mean by the length scale here? It's a lump of fluid that moves together with certain velocity fluctuation in three directions, U prime, V prime, W prime, and it has the maximum amount of turbulence energy. And when the vertical structures twist and bend and stretch, that would create smaller and smaller scales until they go to Kolmogorov length scale. This is just a very quick introduction. Now, if you look at this and plot a spectrum of turbulence energy, and this is here a wave number, inversely proportional to the length scale. Length scale grow this way. L here will be here, has the maximum amount of energy, that's a log scale. And when you go to a much smaller length scale, eta, which was on the first slide, you will have no energy whatsoever. And in somewhere in between, there is a Taylor length scale called lambda. So today I'll be discussing particles that are smaller than the Kolmogorov scale. We use the point particles, and particles that are much larger than the Kolmogorov scale, they're almost like a Taylor scale. And we want to know, how do these small, tiny particles influence the spectrum, and as well as these large particles?
What is the Taylor scale? What defines the Taylor scale?
Very good. I'll show next slide. But basically, it's a scale of turbulence at which the effect of dissipation of turbulence starts. Next slide. Okay? These are all log scales. So if we take the spectrum from the previous page and do the semi-log, so this one here is not a log, but this one is a log, that spectrum that you've seen earlier will look like this. And if we plot the dissipation of this energy, the dissipation rate, it's like dE by dt of this, you get this. It shows that the dissipation occurs at much smaller scales and peaks around 5 Kolmogorov or 6 Kolmogorov scale. Taylor here is at the beginning of the dissipation takes action. Okay? So we'll be dealing with the effect of particles on turbulence kinetic energy and dissipation rate. In 1991-94, I created this map because there was no map at the time to know what the influence of particle is. And this here is called volume fraction. It's a volume of particles divided by the volume of the control volume with the gas of the gases. The ordinate is a Stokes number, particle response time over the Kolmogorov's time scale. This tau p was devised by Stokes in 1842-45, rho particle g squared over molecular viscosity of the fluid. This comes from Stokes solution of a settling sphere in a stagnant fluid at a very low Reynolds number, creeping flow, and rho particle must be much bigger than rho. You can derive it immediately. in a few minutes. The Kolmogorov scale time, kinematic viscosity over the dissipation, which I showed you in the spectrum earlier, to the square root. So I'm saying between 0 and 10 minus 6 volume fraction, I call this one-way coupling. The fluid influences particle, but there's no feedback. Negligible effect on turbine. Between 10 minus 6 to 10 minus 3, you create two-way coupling. Then you've definitely fluid will influence particle and vice versa. If you go beyond this, you will have particle-particle collision. And if you reach 10 to the 0, this is where Professor Jenkins' granular flow will be. And that's beyond, above my pay grade. I don't do that. We call this four-way coupling. Okay? Then with the DNS at that time, between 91 and this, they found particle enhanced dissipation when the Stokes number less than 100. And after that, you have bullets. They will increase production. But again, this was modified in 2006 after we did more DNS. So this map here is a skeleton where it can be improved when people do measurements or DNS. What is missing in this map is a third direction for effective gravity. I don't have that. So if you have gravity effects, which we did, you need a coordinate like this, gravity, and then you will have surfaces instead of these lines. But it'll be too complex. Okay? So this really, it's a useful map to, before you do any simulation experiment, to know where you are. I find it useful. There are two main approaches for doing DNS of particle-laden turbulence for small particles. Either you do two fluid, we call it Eulerian layer, in which you treat the particle at a phase, and you saw, you make Navier-Stokes equation for it, and your dependent variable will be the volume fraction of particles. And the velocities of the phase particle and gas will be that what you'll be solving for. The more expensive one is due to trajectory approach. So you do the gas as before, the black arrows heat velocities, the staggered mesh, but you have millions and millions of particles. You follow each one with its own equation, and you summarize, you sum all this to see the effect directly. This is about 10 times more expensive than this, and I can show you a comparison we did many years ago between the two. This was the flat plate turbulent boundary layer that has bubbles in it, was for the Navy to see drag reduction with bubbles. And this one here, the Reynolds number was 2 million. And how do you think that was the largest simulation at that time, 2004, that 10 years ago. And you see the turbulent boundary layer, the developing boundary layer, with these bubbles here. If you do that with the Lagrangian, it means you follow 100 million bubbles one by one. And this one, you do the Eulerian approach. So it's almost like comparing DNS with LDS, but both of them are DNS. And you can see here, see maximum concentration power will be 10%. The red points here, we cannot only capture only 5%. Means you lose information, you get the main picture, if that's what you're in, but you pay here $1,000, you pay here probably $100. So it's a very expensive thing. Yes?
Do people ever do Lagrangian simulations?
Means you will follow both fluid and particle separately.
Well, you could formulate the Navier-Stokes equation.
Right, right. So that means you have to assume that the fluid particles, which is originally a continuum, but nobody will have computer big enough to do that.
Okay, what about smooth? What do they call it? Smooth
multi-dynamics.
Yeah, so there's what I would think of as a Lagrangian technique for fluid.
Most of the people who did fluid Lagrangian particle, they will be following two particles or four particles
I see.
To see the time correlations. but not to do this kind of,
okay.
Right? Yeah, very good. So, just to show you that, Mr. Wow, it's already, okay. I am far below, I mean, time. Okay. So now, equations. So we're done doing DNS of particles using the Lagrangian approach, small particles, and the Navier-Stokes equation. And the only difference it has here, a source term based on the forces that the particles impart on the fluid. Okay? And then you have to have an equation for the particle, and that's what it is. Newton's second law of motion, mass and acceleration equal the Dirac term, pressure gradient term, the added mass term, virtual mass, the Bassett history term, the buoyancy term, and some Fexan terms, which allows for the velocity around the particle to be non-uniform, and that term is small because d function of dp over eta squared, and we can see here this equation is valid only for dp much less than eta and Reynolds number of the particle much less than one. If you violate either of these conditions, this equation is invalid. And this took 140 years to develop. Stokes, Businescu, Bassett, Faxin, Ossie, Chen, Kortsen, Lumley, Govich, Riley, Next and Riley, Gatignol, and this lady here from France, the beautiful piece of work, but no, not many people know about her, and therefore I always put her journal paper. It was done in this French journal, not many people read in the US, but excellent work, actually. She did a beautiful piece of work, and the paper is written in English. Okay. So now we have the Navier-Stokes and this equation of motion to compare with a beautiful experiment by Snyder and Lumley in JFM in 1971. Beautiful experiment because elegant and physics. So what they did, they have three particles, one made of corn pollen, one of solid glass. Both of them have the same diameter, 87 microns, which is about 10% of Kolmogorovsky, very small. Then they, solid glass and copper, they both have the same tau p. So the experiment wants to know, would these two particles of the same diameter disperse in a wind tunnel in the same way, or would these two? Very elegant. Nobody knew the answer at that time. Nobody, in 1971. And that, to me, is my best paper I've seen. And we then, they have 10 cameras, follow particle in a wind tunnel, vertical wind tunnel at, I don't know if he did it in Pennsylvania before he moved to Cornell. I'm not sure. I think it was done in Penn State, right. Because he moved, I think, in 1978 to, right?
Yeah.
I visited. Okay, perfect. So, remind you again that the tau p is rho particle d square over viscosity from Stokes. So, here is the result, and our DNS as well. So, the ordinate is the dispersion, means if you have a particle in a tunnel like this, it goes sideways like this, and x and y, and z is the vertical. And it shows that x squared of the two particles of the same tau p are nearly identical. The symbols are Lumley's, the lines are my DNS. And for the two particles of the same diameter, they disperse differently. So the diameter is not important. That was important. So this I told that that's the importance of tau p. Notice that these are all tiny particles. And in DNS, you can do things like switching the gravity off. You can see particles in zero gravity disperse far more than the fluid particle. Fluid particle has no gravity, so. You see, So this was important. So this was the first verification of Lamley's experiment. How about two-way coupling? Now it can be, well, at that time it's done only in DNS, so 93, and repeated again with a bigger computer 10 years later. And the results look like this. All test cases will have the same volume and mass fraction, all of them. The only difference will be the Stokes number to see the effect of this. And so the volume fraction was 10 minus 3. The mass fraction is 100%, although the volume fraction is small. This is like water droplets, liquid water droplets in air. And we have 80 million particles. At that time, in 2003, that was a big job to do now. And so we have cases here. Case E, no particles. The Stokes number 0.1, 0.25, 1, and 5. But the diameter is always smaller than the Kolmogorov. Otherwise, you cannot use the equation of motion. The results are like this. E here is the kinetic energy of turbulence, this E. So think of a wind tunnel. You create turbulence in a grid, and you leave the turbulence alone, it decays. That's a wind tunnel grid decaying turbulence. So that would be the ordinate here, normalized by the beginning, and this time. And the black line is if you have no particles. That's a decay rate, which is measured by people and verified. And here, the arrow here, increasing the Stokes number from a very small to very large. So the first one, we did microparticles. We found out that the microparticles delay the decay of turbulence energy. So preserve the initial kinetic energy, doesn't decay as much. Then we increased more, we went these large particles. So the small particles, I mean tau p is big. Then I said, okay, there, if we cross this line, there must be somewhere in between when we match it with, so by trial and error, we found a particle, we call a ghost particle. It is there, but it has no effect on the kinetic energy of turbulence. And at that time, yes?
Is there a way to understand why there's no effect at Earth time?
We will explain in detail everything. Thank you. So, the important thing is, this was NASA at that time in 2000, they wanted to have a box experiment in a space station, and when I asked them, what are you going to see the effect of the particle, they said, well, look at the kinetic energy of turbulence, it's easy. You put lasers and you get U squared, V squared. I told them, but we have a particle that is there but has no effect. See, so, and actually in the paper I wrote that it is not a good measure, and I'll explain now. So remember this one, this is the kinetic energy of turbulence, how about the dissipation? Okay, we found out the microparticles increase the dissipation quite a bit. The ghost particle also increases it. But there is a particle, critical particle, it is there, but the dissipation doesn't know that exists. It's almost like a single phase. That's really was fascinating. And when you see this for the first time, you tell the student, go back and check. The student was Ferranti, he's now a professor, assistant professor in Washington. We checked, and we had to do more work to find out why. So the smallest particle caused the maximum increased dissipation because they allow turbulence to retain its kinetic energy longer. We'll do that in more detail. Critical particles have negligible effect on dissipation. So there is a flow called Taylor-Green vortex. It's a counter-rotating vortex, so all of equal size. And we put particles, tiny ones, small Stokes number. The fluid point is red, that's a Lagrangian computation, and the particle is blue. So this is, we follow a fluid particle in time. And you can see if you have large particles, I mean large tau p, the centrifugal forces allow the particle, the blue here, to leave the trajectory of the fluid point that it was with it at time zero, where the small particle are retaining their position in the vortex, so that we need that information. So here is schematic. If you have large particles moving like this with a uniform velocity, and they meet a vortex, the Dirac term is called V minus U. So if you subtract this minus this, you will create a counter-rotating vortex. So the large particles kill the turbulence because of this local action. And you can see that from the equation of vorticity normal to the page. And there is a term made from Navier. If you take the curl of Navier-Stokes equation, you will get this here. It's a gradient of the force here, which creates this counter-rotating. So that's how you kill the turbulence in large particles. For a small particle, the very tiny one, they are they reside longer in a vortex, as I showed you from Taylor Green. Their velocity like this, they're rotating with the vortex, minus the existing fluid vortex. You get a Dirac term, you get actually a little increase in the same direction. And that's why the microparticles delayed the decay of turbulence. And if you look at, take a small piece of the box, that's a cube, and you will see that the small particles have no preferential accumulation, and they spread everywhere. The red is positive vorticity, the blue is negative vorticity, normal to the page. And if you go to the tiny particles, and you can see they actually leave the zone of maximum vorticity here by they accumulate outside in the perimeter here. And if you remember the very first spectra of dissipation, this part here was maximum dissipation. Remember that picture here? I said the maximum dissipation occurs about 6 chromogroups. So when the particles leave the zone of maximum dissipation, you can see those particles have no effect on it. That's why the microparticle left the dissipation of energy unchanged. Now, this is a little piece, a new one. For people who do subgrid scale model, largely the simulation of, with particles, it's a difficult task because particles here, when you do larger dissimulation, you chop that piece of the spectrum away, you resolve this piece, and you model this piece. But to model this piece, you need always, as you've seen from the particle equation of motion, you need the local fluid velocity of the particle, but you don't have it. You already threw away that piece. So really, any larger dissimulation with particles, I consider suspect at present. Okay, I don't think I have time to do that. We can look at why or how particles modify the spectrum in detail. We do this when we study triadic interaction, and we can do all this in the wave number space. It explains your early question, which is how do they modify, but I can show you results. I'll skip this. This is the transfer, that's the source term effect on the spectrum. And the transfer rate between the wave number, again, is detailed. It just takes time to explain. But this one here shows you when you put particles in the turbulent flow, this is early time, next time I'll show you later time, the particles here in this part, they start influencing that part of the high wave number. And by triadic interaction, the effect travels to the large scale. Look at that, from here, from this to this, and later on. So the question was, how do ghost particles keep the spectrum, how keep the energy the same? Was your question? Or someone?
No. Initially, why is there no energy?
Okay, so what happens, actually, I wrote it actually here. Ghost particles pivot the energy spectrum in such a way that it added some energy here to this part here, high wave number, and remove it from this in such a way that the integral is the same. All other particles do not do that. Like the large particles cut a big chunk of the important, remember that's a log scale, you see that right here. So the green particles, which are ghost particles, that part of added here, pivoted here, and you remove this piece here, there, when you integrate that, because this is very high energy, this is very low energy, if you the integral of E of k dk, you will get the same area under the curve. So,
what do you mean by pivot?
Pivot means, I wish I have a.
Just rotate a little bit, right? So you know, some of it moves under and some.
Or like, if let us say if you do not pivot, means you take an equal amount of all this like this. Mm-hmm. Pivoting means if the black one is the original without particle, you can see the green light is above the black, but it's below the black here. Like there is a point in the middle at a critical wave number in which the effect here is positive, the effect here is that when you integrate, they cancel.
Where is the right curve law?
Say again?
Where is the right curve law in this graph?
Where is what?
Well, okay.
Notice that when we do these simulations, this was done 10 years ago, in order to do an inertial subrange Mach 5/3, you need a much larger Reynolds number. Nobody in DNS can show inertial subrange. Nobody, really. And they put the line -5/3 on any curve, it doesn't mean anything. Inertial subrange, I tell you what, inertial subrange, you remember in the very beginning I showed you dissipation spectrum in blue, energy spectrum in red. To have inertial subrange, those two spectra have to be far apart, and the transfer is uniform. Nobody can do that. This one here, RE lambda, is like 100 or so. In order to get inertial subrange, you need RE lambda more than 1,000. There are few cases in Japan where they did this, but still, yeah. But I've seen many, and when you ask them, how do you put -5/3 on a low Reynolds number, they say, you just put it there to, just to show. -5/3 require a very large energy number, very large.
What's the increase in the spectrum in between them? The second point, the increases and then decreases again.
Could you please repeat?
There's an increase and then a decrease again.
Right.
What's the reason for that?
Okay, so I tried to do it, but I'll. Okay. Even I need an equation for that. Here it is. I tried to skip it, but I. Okay. If you write an equation for the energy, this is the amount of turbulence energy at a given wave number. And influence it, if you have no particle, you only have this transfer between large scale, small scale, or vice versa, minus the dissipation. This is the equation of it's written here. When you have particle, this guy here becomes active. And psi p, it can be computed. In real space, it looks like this. Mass fraction times the, it's almost the Dirac term times u, because, yes. And but this term here, when you multiply two quantities with two different wave numbers, you create another one with a third wave number. And correct? I call it radic interaction. Now, so this is the effect of the particles in that term here. You see, microparticles put a lot of energy in the positive. In reality, you can have, see the large particle with the vortex interaction took a negative amount at a given wave number and added little here. Where the microparticles took a little from the low wave number but added a lot. You see, and the ghost particle, the pivoting things here. And then, I then wanted to skip all that. This is the transfer between wave number, and that curve is known if you have no particle, the solid line. That's a standard curve. Look now. Particles affected the whole thing because of triadic interaction. That is why I said people who do large AD simulation, chopping this piece here, you lose a lot of information, right? So the shape of the spectrum modification comes because of these three terms, chi of k, epsilon of k, and psi of k.
The spectrum for the particle concentration field, is it just a flat or is it?
Here, you see? It's this term here.
Phi m.
Phi m. Okay, so that's a mass fraction. For all these rounds, phi m was constant, 100%.
Variations within the flow.
Of course, you can do many things. This whole study was to see the effect of tau p. It's crucial because later on, when we do a large particle, you can see all this is a different story.
You showed us that the particles move away from regions of high vorticity, so there should be an anticorrelation between.
Okay, only if you have the ratio of tau p over the tau of the fluid. If it's larger, they will go out. If it's small, very ratio, they will retain themselves in the part, in the vortex. So it depends on tau p over tau v, the Stokes number. They are not all go out.
And a lot of your explanation, you didn't say anything about the strain.
A lot of detail I'll give you in a minute. Okay, I mean, this can go on for hours. I'm just trying to compress 30 years of work in, right? But I'm glad to, yeah. Yes, so I will. You see here, yeah, that's it. That's fine.
Skip.
Yes, sir.
When you are doing particle image velocimetry and you are putting small particle, this means that you are altering the energetic balance of the flow?
Hmm. Well, yeah, many people ask me, Caltech people, Garib and all these, and Srinivas asked me many years ago about this. And yeah, so in general, if you put something in there, it will affect it, yes. However, they put, usually PIV, they use particles. They say buoyant, and they give me the diameter. Sometimes they tell me 20 microns, 10 microns. But if you put many of them, they will do something. This map shows. However, to me, my main concern, even an LDV, is near wall region. Near wall region, you have vertical structures do funny things. And particles near the wall, they behave differently. So PIV measurement near the wall, in my opinion, is less accurate than away from the wall. Okay. Yes.
I think you have to be careful. It's different when you are doing PIV in water, where you can have very, very carefully matched neutrally buoyant particles. They behave like fluid particles, and if you do it in gas, and you're trying to put what you're trying to do, the particles are always going to be heavier than the gas, so you're trying to lower the size, but then you're lowering the scattering cross-section, and so there is a balance there that typically is tilted towards larger particles to get good images, and then you start to have this problem.
Right, so I discussed with those old people who are doing this experiment with PIV, for 20 years now. And I always have these questions, but it's the best you can do. But yes, when you put something in a fluid, in a turbulent fluid, you will do something to it, definitely.
There will be no neutral free set.
Yeah, there's, yeah, stuff. Yeah. Say it again, I didn't hear.
You can compare with VNS and see if you get the spectrum.
Right, right. Yeah, it's, but when you deal with turbulence, you're always fighting, always. If you put gravity, which we did, the vertical structure becomes like a banana, and actually in the paper I wrote that word, bananas. And the Chinese paper now, they also call it bananas.
So in which direction is gravity pointing?
Down, yes, here, on the right side, right. And they influence the trajectories also, and the segregation. So in 2001, I modified that based on this. So the map is still under construction, but still the main skeleton is still there. Now, homogeneous shear flow. Okay, so I wanted to know now, so we did the isotropic turbulence, how about if we have shear flow? Because this is an important flow, and I'll just, there are many cases, just today we'll concentrate on cases A and B because of time. A has no particle, B will have particles. S here is the mean vorticity, which is measuring the mean shear du dx3. Beautiful experiment again from UC San Diego 1988 by Van Hatter's group, in which they have a wind tunnel where they created mean shear at the grid with special grid. And you can see that for different shear numbers, that the energy, U prime is a fluctuation, but the energy always grows indefinitely. There is no length scale here. So the energy, this is time. Energy will continue because you're forcing the shear rate on the flow. Beautiful experiment. So we did DNS, and you can see for case A, we get the same thing. Initial, this takes time for the structure to organize. Then A, case A, no particles. The shear, the energy as a function of time increases. And we put particles, look at what happened. It killed, it almost make it decaying. That's a shear flow, very powerful shear. And I was surprised. So the equation will be like this, d by dt. Now we have a third term called the production. The mean shear, times the Reynolds stress, dissipation, and particle effect. So remember that, killed it. So I want to know how. And we looked at the production term. Remember, production of turbulence is a large scale phenomenon, not a small, not a Kolmogorov scale. Production of turbulence occurred at the large scale. These are the big crunching vortices. So how could tiny particles, very tiny, smaller than Kolmogorov, affect the production? So here is the production. Case A, no flow, no particles. Case B, that's a negative quantity. You need a negative here. So more negative means more turbulence production. It reduced the magnitude of the shear stress production. The spectra will look the same. I can go into the detail, but basically it killed the turbulence kinetic energy spectrum and also the dissipation. But this is the spectrum of the production term. Remember, as I said earlier, production for no particles is a large-scale phenomenon. This is low wave number. And we found that the production spectrum reduced. This is, to me, was honestly a great surprise. I thought that would increase dissipation, I think, but never the production because that's a large. So it took really 2 years to figure out what happened. And to go back to the physics, if you have a shear flow like this, meeting a lump of fluid in which the vorticity on the average was going up like this, the vorticity vector, makes it an ellipsoid, looks like this, and in time, it even more inclined. However, once you create vorticity aligned like this, it have by Biot-Savart law, it creates a velocity around it. And this velocity interacts with the original vorticity normal to the peak to create these yellow arrows to prevent this from going flat like that. And this was done by Kida and Tanaka.
What are the significance of the yellow arrows?
In the equation here? Very important, yellow arrow. This is the equation of vorticity at any direction. This is advection without direction of change. These terms are crucial. This one here, minus S, is the vorticity normal to the page due to this shear, multiplied by this term du I dx2. The interaction of this black arrow created by these vortices with the mean vorticity that come from this guy creates this guy here. It's a very important term. It creates that yellow arrow. It shifts this vorticity vector of the inclined structure a little bit. Dotted line.
Can we think of this in terms of angular momentum?
Yes, but it's an interaction between two. One is created by this mean here. This guy is a mean vorticity I'm creating all the time. It's a negative. Interacting with the... Okay. Interacting with this guy here, created by this guy, interacting with the original one I'm putting in, creates that term. Interaction between the imposed mean vorticity minus S and the induced velocity with this black arrow.
Yeah, but it's kind of perpendicular to both
exactly
elements of the angular velocity, a little bit like a precession.
Exactly, yeah. It is, perfect. But the result of this, it prevents the structure from lying flat. That's the main thing. So you will create vertical structure at an angle to the mean flow.
What would that angle be?
We measured it. I have all the statistics. We have it all written. It's a whole paper about this. But I'm trying to summarize. If the vorticity originally was downward, it's the same thing. That yellow term prevents this guy from lying down. And here it is, PDF of that term, PDF of this yellow term. If you have no particles, it will look almost, not exactly, but nearly Gaussian, with tails are very small. If you put particles, it increases the magnitude, means it will prevent this guy from lying down, it will actually make it stand up. And that, it disturbs the interaction or production of turbulence because the zone of maximum production in turbulence energy is between two counter-rotating vortices. This paper is by Adrian and Moyne, 88, and Kida and Tanaka. So you need two vertical structures like this, and the crunching between them will create turbulence, this hatched area here. So then I said, there must be particle change that angle, and it is. Wow. Oh, I'm not good at this. So here is one of the inclined vertical structures. Omega S means the vorticity vector along the axis of that structure. Okay. And this plane here, we took the flow and we measured the angle and we put a plane normal to omega s and we measured the vorticity with these blue and red mean these counter-rotating vortices and we measured the shear stress. And the black area is a contour of this magnitude here. Exactly, we find the maximum production between counter-rotating vortices. Okay, and now we want to know what particles will do to that. In order to do this, we have to measure angles again. And here's a summary. If you have no particles, these angles, they come from this. They come from the sum, the first we do the pressure hessian, and we found the core of the vertical structures. And the color on each line is the sum of the two positive eigenvalues of the hessian. It tells you how much vorticity along these lines. When you put particles, these guys become vertical, almost, because of the yellow term. So the difference between this is the yellow term. The paper has all the angles in all the three directions of detail, but I cannot show it here. And we then, this is the one without particles, and look now with particles. The black areas are all gone, and the magnitude of vorticity is diminished. So why shear stress production is reduced? Particle to change the alignment of the vertical structure with the mean shear. That's the answer. This was 14 years ago. Now I'm going to the large particles, which are not point particles. You cannot use what I said before. Now we have to do something else.
Can I ask a question?
Yes, sir.
So did the particles change the vorticity of the tubes?
Yes, absolutely. Here. I actually, if I look at the, I have all the slides here, but I hide them, so I only show the little. But I have all the questions you have. And look at the magnitude of vorticity here. Compare this. Look at the color, how dark blue and dark red. Look at this.
So the vorticity of the tubes is reduced by the particle.
Absolutely. And more than that, these vertical structure, the tubes incline, they create turbulence between them. And when the vorticity is gone on those tubes, you have no production. So the particles basically change the structure angles. That's the main thing. And see, these particles, they're very tiny, but there are so many of them, the mass fraction is 100%.
If you want to just increase the viscosity of the fluid, put an effective viscosity, there's the suspension viscosity rather than the fluid viscosity.
Okay. That's okay, very good question. So if you want to use Einstein formula 1905, that would not play here. To modifying molecular viscosity has nothing to do with what I'm talking about here. It's really a turbulent structure. Yeah. I have also another beautiful paper, 1960, the first person ever to say that the particles reduce drag. It was published in Nature in 1960, and Safman was so angry about it. I have all this here, I can show you. But it is not molecular viscosity, it's turbulent structure.
But, yeah. But the particles are influenced in small scales. Cumulative effect is to contribute to the vorticity of a tube.
Yes, but not molecular viscosity.
No.
Oh, perfect.
The turbulent velocity fluctuations at small scale.
Exactly.
No. Okay.
However, the production is a large scale phenomenon, not small scale. By changing, think of these vortices like this, and you slow them down a little bit. They are big, but they're carrying this load with them. Therefore, they cannot produce turbulence as well as they did before. Okay, now we go to the next part. These are large particles. If you want me to stop, it's not 11:30, I stop, but this is very important. Shall
this
I continue?
This is a very strong audience.
Okay. If you're bored, tell me you're bored. And okay. So now we're dealing with these guys here.
One question.
Yes, sir.
So if someone wants to perform a RAND simulation.
Yeah, RANDs.
Yes. Using this information.
Okay. So I can show
can
you.
Can you do something or not?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Yes, you can. So you need some. I used to work on RANDs for many years. Imperial people, you know, that's where RANDs was. And you can understand these results very well and go to specific terms in the kinetic energy and epsilon equation and do it. And I can show you a paper on that. Right. So now we're in a different game. We used to have particles in this region here. Now we're putting particles of this size. Okay? So they're not point particles. You cannot ignore their size.
Sorry, next question.
Yes.
The typical Kolmogorov scale for Rieber.
Say it again.
The typical Kolmogorov length scale for Rieber is of order.
Well, if you the river Reynolds number is quite huge, right? The
yeah.
same as may not be. Well, the rho is quite hard. For the atmosphere, the Kolmogorov scale is about 1 millimeter. In a river, probably the same 1 millimeter.
1 millimeter.
Right.
So if we have sand.
I'm not an expert on river, but. Of the order of a millimeter, not centimeter, right? Higher on okay. Yes.
So if you have sand, which is about a millimeter,
yes.
then you have an interaction between the
absolutely.
Two.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
So it's a mess.
Yeah, rivers, yeah. The sand will affect, of course, yeah. They will affect the Mount St. Helen and the and Etna and all these things. Yes.
But in that situation, it would be that we would be dealing with particles that are smaller than the Kolmogorov scale.
What they did, but this one here would be larger than
now you're dealing with.
Now we will give it, so this will cover Mount St. Helen and Mount Etna, because I've seen pictures of what comes out. These are big ones.
Mm. Okay.
Yeah.
And what is the magnitude of the Taylor scale in comparison with the Kolmogorov?
The magnitude of what?
The Taylor scale.
Here. Okay. You want to see the size of it?
In comparison with the Kolmogorov.
No, let's say 30 times or 40 times. It depends on Reynolds number. Remember when I said earlier, when you increase the Reynolds number, these guys go far apart. The ratio between the lot, the ratio between the large scale here and the small scale equal Reynolds number to the 3/4. So the larger the Reynolds number, that spectrum will spread like this. That's for when people said minus 5/3, you need a much larger gap between the two. I cannot put minus 5/3 here. Yeah. So the people who did resolve the particles, this group from Holland, Johns Hopkins, changed quite a bit, but he's now in Maryland.
Resolve the particles means applying no slip boundary conditions on
the
particles?
Yes, correct. Yes, real.
On the surface of the particle.
Correct.
Yeah.
Yes, that's a real thing. He is now in Kalazua, great man, and this is with it. We use something called immersed boundary. Why? To avoid using body fitted grid. And when you have a body fitted grid, when the particle moves, you have to remesh. It costs billions of dollars for a run. So that's the motivation of using this. The idea is to solve Navier-Stokes equation throughout the domain, including the particle's interior. Then you impose local constraint, means no slip. That's the whole idea. And this method was discovered by Peskin, who does biomedical flows. He was studying the flow in the heart. He created that method in 1972, I think. And the first step is to take this large particle and cover it with Lagrangian point. And it's not a straightforward thing to require the Nobel Prize to do it. The C60 molecule, and these gentlemen from Scandinavia created a model to put them uniformly. And the idea is you have the surface of the particle, and the black dots are the Lagrangian points on the previous slide, and the green here is the Eulerian mesh where the fluid Navier-Stokes solved, and you want to impose the no-slip condition, so you want to get you apply a force to Navier-Stokes equation that allows the difference between this velocity and the fluid velocity at that point to be zero, and you put this force to make them fit, basically. And this, to do that, from Peskin, it's a three-dimensional, three-point delta function. It has 27 points to do this trick. And Ullmann was a great man to do that, and again here. Navier-Stokes, same look as before, and you have a force.
Let me ask the same question again. Why not phrase the Navier-Stokes equations in a Lagrangian way?
Okay, so let us say you have a box fluid, and how many you want to do. It's almost like molecular dynamics. You want to trace every fluid point to achieve Navier-Stokes equation. That's the whole point.
Yeah, but it seems to me that it's not much different than solving for a velocity field at each point in space and time.
Okay.
It's another equation you have to carry with you to give you the positions.
Right. So it's just a matter of money. That's all. Philosophically, yes, but
So it seems like a natural way to deal with.
Oh, by the way, Lagrangian motion is the natural way of doing everything, because that's life. Eulerian is just an artifice of mathematics we do, right? Yeah.
Yeah, and maybe I can interrupt. In some sense, Lagrangian simulations have been done, if you think of vortex methods. Lagrangian vortex methods.
I don't know what those are.
So that's when you essentially say, you represent all the fluid particles that carry vorticity as Lagrangian elements, and then at every time step you have to let them interact with each other so that you solve the proper momentum balance, and then you advance them along. But it's often difficult with these Lagrangian methods to account for vorticity or to satisfy even the continuity equation can be difficult under some circumstances. So they have their own computational difficulties.
Yeah, that makes wall interaction and
I think it's shorter.
I don't quite understand that. I mean, it seems like a lock exchange problem, for example. Mm-hmm. We have a finite amount of fluid, you know where it is initially,
right.
And you could phrase it then as an initial boundary value problem.
So you would let each fluid element move individually,
yeah.
And then you have to somehow account, you know, how do you solve the force equations? How do you account for
rephrase the Navier-Stokes equation in terms of the original spatial variables. I map it back to every fluid particle back to the original configuration.
Yes, but how do you account for pressure and those kinds of things?
Well, that's what I don't understand.
Yeah,
that may be. Mm-hmm. I know it's difficult in the Eulerian formulation, and it may be even more difficult in the Lagrangian. I don't know about that. What I would do is make the fluid slightly compressible. I guess I introduce lots of ways that they do.
By the way, we're doing other fluid problems using Letts-Boltzmann equation.
Yeah.
And paralyzable and pressure problems gone. We don't do Poisson equation, I think. So we're doing a probability density function of fluid points, and much cheaper than Navier-Stokes equation, very accurate, but use it only for complex geometry that you cannot do with Navier-Stokes. So I guess I can show details of this, that's another, but the vorticity method, you need assumptions about the interaction that was shorter.
And the vorticity method gets rid of the pressure. So that
the pressure's gone, right. But if you want to retrieve it, you have to do something.
Yeah.
You have to go to something else. Okay, so we are not doing, we are doing Eulerian Lagrangian, cheaper. And then now you solve the particle equation completely, including the mass time acceleration, all the stresses around the surface, including pressure, buoyancy, and if you have collision, you do something like that. So the whole complete, right? We no more particle motion equation of, I showed you earlier. You do the angular momentum again with everything. And we do not do hard collision. We do something to prevent overlapping. So we do Glowinski stuff. There are people in Germany now who are doing the collision we saw in the Chateau, right? And there's something else. I am not. Okay, so to validate this, the only thing we had was a French experiment by Mordal et Ponton, and in which a particle settling in a tank, and we get agreement between terminal velocity in time, very good agreement. And the density ratio here was 2.56, the error was 1%. And it looks like this. This is DNS of a particle, the vorticity around it, no slip, everything. And many cases, I think you were asking something about lambda, or somebody was asking about numbers. So the density until 10, we now do density of 1,000. This was 4 years ago. The diameter of our lambda is about 1 or 2. So the ratio between 35, you say, somebody was asking how big is lambda compared to eta. I don't remember who asked. Between 20 and 30, right? For this kind, if you have a larger Reynolds number, the ratio will increase. So the idea here, the energy of turbulence always decay when you increase volume fraction, mass fraction. You would never see here above this black line, which you had point particles. Now they're not. They cannot do that. Explain that in a minute. These particles, this is a very important picture because this here, So these particles, B and C and D, are with the same tau p over tau k. In the point particle, if you have tau p over tau k the same, you get the same result. So now it's a breakdown of the idea of a Stokes number. That's the first time, and it's very important. And if you do spectra here, since in this boundary, you have to do fast Fourier transform within the flow. When you have an obstacle like a particle, you get noise like this. And this is because if you have do Fourier transform of a step function like this, you'll create noise like that. So we have to do something else. We have to really go to Lagrangian. So, so now instead of doing wave number space, we do frequency space. So this will be energy as a function of frequency. You don't have noise anymore, because to do this, we have to follow fluid particles, 100,000 fluid points Lagrangian to create the spectra. You see? But we had Navier-Stokes first to get this information from. We could not have started. See? That's the main thing. And you can see now increasing volume fraction, mass fraction will lower the energy. And again, increasing tau p, you get different results, which is completely different from the. So smallest diameter causes maximum reduction of energy, we will explain later. Largest tau p causes minimum reduction. So it's a whole different thing than point particles. And here is just, this to show on the right side, what's more by itself, okay. So these are real particles. And what you have here is a vorticity normal to the page. And you can see particles almost near collision, they stay away from each other. The particles are uniform size, but when you see smaller diameter, mean they are leaving that plane. And you can see that particles create vorticity around them, and therefore they change the whole structure. So the question is, for large particles, is Stokes number a good indicator? And the answer will be obvious in a minute. To answer on this, we made different cases. These are the cases. All the particles have the same tau p. Therefore, if the density goes up, the diameter has to go down. So the density is the green, and the diameter is here. Five cases. And when you go closer to the particle surface, we can do by DNS, you can see the strain rate increases considerably near the particle surface. Sij is a strain rate tensor. The square of it is the dissipation rate without the viscosity. And the strain rate increases as the particle diameter decreases. And all cases here have the tau p over tau k the same. It's completely different from point particles. Smallest particle causes maximum increase. And because of this, when you have a smaller particle, the curvature around it increases more than a bigger particle. And therefore, the strain rate increases and the dissipation increases. So this is.
Where is lambda for these five particles?
Very good. Excellent. This is eta. See how eta is small here? And this here is about lambda. So within, for the Eulerian mesh, you will have 32 lines inside, resolve everything, right? And velocity gradient near the surface increase. That's why the dissipation increases. And I think I have not activated this from here. I don't have that, but I can activate it from here. So it shows you that this is dissipation, Sij, Sij. You see how he used dissipation near the particle. This is no particle now. the RMS of particle, these large particle, the smallest one have large RMS, and the diameter increases with, so although they have the same tau p, they do not have the same effect on the fluid.
This is,
yes,
actually the ratio between the large scale length scale to the particle diameter, right?
So the,
because you are fixing the box, the size,
correct,
of the box.
Yes, yes. So this will be 6,000 particles in a box, and L is much larger than lambda. Lambda is the size of the particle.
No, that's okay.
Right? It's a large box. You're talking about the effect of the size of the domain on the right. This is a periodic boundary condition in a large box. So, yeah.
But you say lambda is the size of the particle?
Right, approximately, yeah, 1.2 or so, yes.
But by what you said earlier, shouldn't we expect that the particle with, that is exactly lambda is the one that minimizes both the influence of the particle on dissipation and conduction?
Okay.
Isn't that where lambda lives? Lambda lives kind of in a valley between the two?
Correct. Lambda lives between the valley of the two. Perfect. When you have a particle like this, it creates fluid vortices around it with different scale, much even smaller. But if you look at the picture before, it's a very good question. So, you see how the thin dissipation region compared to the particle size? These are scales much smaller than the particle diameter. You see? So the particle is big, but it creates a disaster around it in 3D.
At smaller scale?
At smaller scale, yes, absolutely. Right? Okay, I hope I'm closer to the end. Kinetic energy of turbulence. You can see the kinetic energy where particles are reduced than the one with fluid only, right? It kills it because of large dissipation.
How long is the particle Reynolds number here? How long is the particle Reynolds number?
The particle Reynolds number is difficult to measure, and we wrote that in the paper. It will be between 80 and 90, because when you measure Reynolds number of a particle, if you know free stream velocity, then diameter divided by viscosity, there is no free stream here. They're very close. No, we said V particle divided, you get about 80 or 90. Nobody in a laboratory or DNS can measure particle Reynolds number. Nobody, because the fluid is no free stream. So the Stokes number should not be used as an indicator for modulation of turbulence. This is a major event, and really people have to think how to use large particle and say, what's the Stokes number? It has no meaning, because only for point particle, because that's what Stokes did. He did for creeping flow. If there are dimensionless parameter can be used, no, not at present. We are still working on it to find a Stokes number for large particles, something like that. And I think I can, there is a summary after that, but it will take, you probably should ask questions now.
You could go for another 10 minutes.
Okay. So the summary, okay, perfect, okay. This is for small particles, I mean the tiny particles called GP less than eta. They can increase, decrease, or keep on a change the decay rate of turbulence energy, depending on their Stokes number. This is important, and you remember that picture. So here, the Stokes number was the main guy to tell you what will particles do. You get more, less energy, or the same. All cases have the same volume mass fraction. Dissipation, you remember that. you can have particle that does not do anything to dissipation that can increase or decrease. So small particle can do anything. For large particles, they always, they reduce decay. So if you have a volcano, be assured that the kinetic energy of turbines will be smaller always than a single phase. And the dissipation will increase.
Said, this might be a technical question, but all of your graphs show that something interesting happens at T equals 1. What happens at T equals 1?
Very good. So beautiful question. So when you start DNS, you will have a box of turbines. You put a spectrum, and you wait for some time until you get the standard spectrum. At that time, you inject particles. Because if you're in the beginning, it has no meaning. So one is you have real turbulence, all the statistics.
Okay. So that's why there's a discontinuity.
Correct, correct. Right. You just inject. Okay. Very good.
Thanks. What is the ratio of the particle diameter to the lambda? It's always constant in
the... You mean for the big ones or for...
In those cases.
So here the range was varied between 1 and 2 lambda.
But when you're saying that you are decreasing the diameter, what happens to the ratio of the diameter to the lambda?
Okay. So lambda, the title would be of the order of lambda. Mm. So what these cases were made like this. We found select particles of different diameter, but mean different, but less lambda, or lambda 0.1, lambda 0.2, lambda 2 lambda. However, keep tau p the same to show you that tau p has no meaning because you have different results, right? So this variation of diameter is still of the order of lambda, but not exactly 1.
Yeah, I was wondering, is decreasing dp means also decreasing vp over lambda?
If you wish, yes, yes. I can actually can go back. If you wish.
Is lambda so precisely defined?
Well, it has a definition, mathematical definition, yes.
And what is integral scale?
No, the integral scale is called L. That is K3 half over epsilon. That's L. That's the largest.
Micro scale. Micro scale?
K kinetic energy of TKE to the 3 half over epsilon is the length scale that contains most of the energy, far left of the spectrum. That's L. And lambda, again, has a different definition based on U prime and epsilon. I can show it to you. It's a different length scale, but it's a defined for a given, yes. And the ratio between L and lambda and eta, all these ratios function of Reynolds number of turbulence, yes.
But I think Diego's question, well, does lambda equal 1 have any special significance?
No. We could have, okay. The title was, we were dealing with particles smaller than the Kolmogorov. They have to be smaller, why? Because the equation of motion derived for 130 years is valid only for d less than eta. Then this time we said...
That's the Kolmogorov.
Correct.
Now we're talking about the Taylor, I see.
Right, so that we have to tell people, the title would have been DNS of large particles. We have to tell people that these are large. We said of the order of Taylor. No, right? And we never said D equal eta. We never said that, say, smaller than the small scale, right? Yeah, sure. So it's not lambda is a God thing. It's just to tell people where we are in the spectrum.
I understand.
Yes?
But also, if you build the Stokes number, you're assuming that the drag force is kind of linear in the difference in the velocity between.
Okay. So these parts.
You do not use a non-linear drag force in order to define them.
We do not do drag force here. We integrate tau around the surface.
Yeah, I was wondering if it's possible to build the
Stokes
number using a non-linear.
It's not good. It's completely different. Completely. Yeah.
Stokes. You need to characterize this case.
That's why I said, how do you define another number for this? We are working on it. This is not tau p. Tau p was derived from a particle settling creeping flow. Because d squared over, right, has nothing to do with this here. Yeah, it's, yeah. So tau p by Stokes has no meaning in this rule because what we just showed. The Stokes number can be used as an indicator for the thermal dispersion of point particles and their modulation, which I showed you. That's perfect. So Stokes number is perfect in this case. For large particle, there is no dimensionless parameter at present can be used as an indicator. Right? We cannot use it. Because I showed it doesn't, I showed you results with the same tau p, they do different things. Right? So you need another time scale. For shear flow, we showed you that they modified this production. Thank you.
Sorry. See, I promised you that we would ask lots of questions.
Sure, well, it's wonderful. That's better than APS.
Well, anything would be better.
But maybe there are a couple more.
Yes, they're right. I work a lot on rivers. On
wonderful.
Large rivers, and we've been looking at turbulence in simplistic ways over the years. And in rivers, you have two components of suspended load.
Yes.
You have the fine material,
correct,
silt clay, the wash load,
yes,
relatively uniform.
That's what I was referring to, yes.
Yeah.
And the other guys on the bottom.
But the other part of it is that we have, and the wash load is typically quite fine, silt and clays.
Yes.
On what we also have, though, are suspended particles from the bed.
Yes.
Sand-sized particles,
yes,
that go up in intermittent,
yes,
suspension, and they decrease in concentration roughly exponentially,
yeah,
from the bed toward the surface.
Yeah.
So are the larger particles going to reduce the turbulent kinetic energy in those kinds of flows?
Okay.
Say a flow that's 10 meters deep.
So let me repeat what I understood,
yep,
from you to make sure I know it. There are two kinds of particles. The floaters, the clay,
yeah,
kind,
yeah,
of
exactly, yeah.
And then the heavy particle, the larger size,
yeah,
particle.
Yeah.
Are they also floating or they decay exponentially to the bottom, to the top?
They decay exponentially,
okay,
to the top.
So, okay. So if somehow you tell me the volume fraction of the tiny to the big ones or the mass fraction, I can give some guess. But the bottom ones, are they moving or sliding over each other, like
being,
sulfating? And
they're being suspended.
Suspended.
Yeah, they're traveling up in the flow column.
Okay.
Yeah.
So definitely the larger one, when they float in the fluid,
yeah,
they will reduce kinetic energy,
okay,
no question.
Okay.
The top one will also reduce, the other one will also reduce kinetic energy.
Okay.
So I would say the answer to the question, can anybody guess what the answer to the river would be? Sediment increase or decrease the bulk?
For the same pressure gradient, I think it could increase. It's going to increase.
Increase what?
The velocity.
Right. So in my opinion,
mm-hmm,
the velocity of the river, will bulk velocity will increase,
okay,
if you have the sediment suspended.
Okay.
And
is that because you're decreasing the vertical mixing in the flow?
You reduce the stresses, shear stresses.
Okay, okay.
And actually I have an experiment for that.
But it's similar to the Volga River.
Yes, but
yeah,
the Volga River, he made that thing without saying anything about particles. He said, if the Volga River became laminar by a miracle, it would be crazy fast. That proved by DNS. But here I'm asking about, if you have clay in the river, the same,
yeah,
river, would it go faster or slower? And my guess is it will go faster.
But you decrease the Reynolds stresses?
Yes, I'll show you.
Decrease the viscosity?
Not viscosity, just stresses. You don't do viscosity. So,
turbulent viscosity.
Turbulent viscosity. Yeah, that's what I meant.
Okay. It's a 500 slide.
There we go.
400. 199, which is the one you want to show.
Huh?
Okay. The very last one.
So this is the thing here, slide show from current one. Little arrow here. So that's a channel flow by McLaughlin Group. And in year 2001, this is after we made the shear flow study.
Yeah.
And you can see here, mass fraction 40%,
mm-hmm.
the gas velocity increased. And the next one, the turbulence stress is reduced.
Mm.
So that tells you right away that the river will speed up.
Mm.
And the first guy who thought about this was in Nature in 1960. And a fascinating paper, you can see if you are a bad reviewer, you create that paper. So I have to And by the way, these are the equation of turbulence if you want to do two fluid. There's no hope. Okay.
One is enough.
This?
This one that you mentioned made Satman angry, yes?
Yes. So this is the first paper ever published. Nature is a good journal, as you know. And he said, if dust is added to a gas flowing,
okay.
right, if the head, the pressure gradient is constant, the addition of this will increase the flow rate, right? But the poor guy, this was accepted in Nature, and he was in a company in LA. He said this is due to the viscosity change.
Well, did he mean turbulent velocity?
No,
viscosity?
No, no,
molecular viscosity.
Einstein.
Oh, okay.
But worse than that, this is 1960. And the reviewer in this journal should know that Einstein, 1905, said the viscosity would increase. We call alpha times 5% and all this.
Molecular viscosity.
Right. This guy said the molecular viscosity decreases. It's against Einstein. And both are wrong. And I'll show you. We'll see what Safran did.
Because if you lower the Reynolds number, you increase the friction coefficient. The only way you can get this is lower, is increasing the Reynolds number.
Yeah. See here?
Lower molecular viscosity.
Oh, I see. Yeah, it's using kinetic gas theory. Yeah.
Wind free path.
Yeah.
And then Safran got so angry. And I met Safran maybe 15 years ago, and we discussed this, and...
Is it still angry?
Well, he's, look at this. I was giving this talk at Imperial and showed them this. Safran said the dust particles do not follow the air, but lag behind. The relative velocity causes an extra dissipation. Look at this guy. He did not do DNS or anything, 1960. Correct answer.
Mm.
And look what the other guy said. Dr. Safran comments introduced some challenging ideas and some nice mathematics which I appreciate. I regret I cannot agree with him. Look at that. But first, like the reviewer in Nature should have said that the viscosity does not decrease by particles. If we follow Einstein, that it's all wrong. But it was the first experimental finding. Okay? And so when we did the experiment, well, I had this already. Anyway, that's all I have. But there are many details. I have all the. Okay.
All right. Do we have any more questions?
I just wanted to make a comment and say you. Very eloquently pointed out that the Stokes number is definitely not the right parameter to characterize particle interaction in turbulence or particle or turbulence modulation by particles, especially for large ones.
Yes.
I think that if you think about it as normal, the Stokes number is comes out in the equations to characterize the inertia of the particle. So it's an important parameter for the dynamics of particles. he says nothing really on what the particle is going to do back into the turbulence, because he has no information about the interaction between the different wave numbers.
However, the Stokes number appears on the right hand side of Navier's of the particle motion equation. But the premise is, to do this equation, you have to have d particles much smaller than quantum law.
Yes.
And Reynolds number is one less than one. Once you violate either one, this equation is not valid. So it's good inertia for that part, yes, we know that. But you cannot take this to a big boulder moving.
I would argue that if you are interested in the dynamics of particles,
yes.
Obviously, the Stokes number, as defined there, is only an approximation for particles that don't have either a small size or a small Reynolds number. But it still contains the right physics. It becomes approximate. But what is obviously not, it's obviously not even the right physics is when you go back into the modulation of turbulence. Then it gives you completely the wrong result. Not just, it doesn't give you an exact result, it gives you qualitatively the wrong result.
That's what I meant. Yeah. It has no connection with physics. Yes. But the river will go faster. When I saw pictures of floods in Germany, you can see that muddy thing moving more than cars or anything, right? It becomes like a colmogorov. I was fascinated when I saw those. They remove cars, they remove.
Unless it becomes laminar, and then
increasing
the molecular response.
What about dust storms?
Same thing.
But
the dust storm is not a confined thing. Mm-hmm. It's the river bank confinement that controls shear stress. Mm-hmm. When you have an open field, there is nothing bounded, right? So they go around Mars or Earth, they destroy land and things like that. So the nearest one will be, the nearest thing to that will be a turbulent boundary laden with particles over a flat plate. So that can erode the land. Like in China, for example, 25% of Western China is gone flat. There is no plant because of that. They have an institute for disasters which mainly looks at the effect of sandstorm on agriculture, which happened in the US in 1930s.
Can I ask a question, Becker? Do you see that in your DNS simulations of particle wave inflows from the Lock exchange versus
policy? We essentially take particles that have no inertia in our simulations, where we have continuum formulations.
Okay. So that's the Roussinesq approximation. The particles are not influencing.
No
inertia. Or?
No. That's true. The particles have no effect on the fluid inertia. That's true. But even if we allow for that, so we can take non-Roussinesq simulations there, but still look at particles that do not move relatively to the fluid. They only have a settling velocity superimposed, and so that means we don't capture the effect.
That's the right one. Okay.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you very much.
Yeah.